June 20, 2021. The sun had barely set over Minneapolis when protesters filled Lake Street again. Signs raised, candles burning, chants echoing between the buildings still scarred from the year before. They gathered to mark 1 year since George Floyd's death and to demand justice for others killed by police. Among them was Deanna Marie Najdek, a 31-year-old mother of two and a steady volunteer who had become a familiar face at marches. Just before midnight, headlights cut through the crowd. Screams broke the rhythm of the chants. A speeding car tore across the barricade and into the group. In seconds, the noise shifted from protest to panic. Phones fell. Sirens followed. By morning, Deanna's name was everywhere. Another life lost, another headline tied to a city still struggling to heal. Chapter 1, The Night of Impact. It was late on a humid Sunday evening in Minneapolis, June 20, 2021. The air carried the mix of summer heat and exhaust from passing cars. On Lake Street, a stretch still marked by boarded windows and murals from the uprisings of the previous year, a group of protesters gathered for what had become a weekly ritual. They met to remember George Floyd and to call attention to others killed during encounters with police. Deanna Marie Najdek arrived just before nightfall. Friends said she came with candles and a folding chair, the same way she had for months. She was 31, a mother of two, and known for her quiet steadiness. Most nights she kept to the edges of the crowd, handing out water bottles and checking that traffic was blocked safely. She had lost friends in car accidents before, and she often reminded others to keep a watch on the barricades. As daylight faded, about 50 people remained along the block near West Lake Street and Girard Avenue. Music played from a Bluetooth speaker. Someone painted a banner. Cars passing on the far side of the barrier honked in support. To many who came often, it felt calm, a vigil more than a protest. At 11:30 p.m., witnesses later told police, a white SUV circled the area once, then again. Some thought the driver seemed impatient, inching near the temporary barricades made of parked cars and orange cones. A few shouted warnings. The third time the vehicle came around, it accelerated. The sound of impact was caught on a live stream. The SUV smashed through two parked cars, skidding toward the cluster of protesters near the intersection. People screamed and scattered. One man tried to wave his arms, signaling for the driver to stop. Another dove out of the way, scraping his leg against the curb. The SUV did not slow. When it finally stopped, it had pinned a woman under a car. The live stream went silent except for shouts. Several people rushed forward, trying to lift the wrecked metal. Others called 911. Paramedics arrived within minutes. Police followed, closing off the intersection with flashing lights that painted the pavement red and blue. Medics pulled Deanna from beneath the vehicle. She was unresponsive. Despite efforts to revive her, she was pronounced dead shortly after midnight, June 21, at Hennepin County Medical Center. Her name spread quickly through social media, confirmed by friends who had been with her that night. Photos of her, smiling, holding her daughters, attending earlier marches, filled timelines before dawn. To many, she was more than a protester. She was part of the community's recovery, one of the people who kept showing up after the cameras left. Police secured the crash site through the early morning hours. Investigators took photographs, measured skid marks, and examined the barricade. Several witnesses provided cell phone footage showing the vehicle entering the area at high speed. One clip showed the driver being detained by bystanders immediately after the crash. They had pulled him from the SUV and held him until officers arrived. The suspect was identified as a 35-year-old man from St. Paul. According to the preliminary report, he appeared impaired. Officers noted the smell of alcohol. Field sobriety tests were conducted at the scene before he was transported to the county jail. By sunrise, the intersection had turned into both a crime scene and a memorial. Candles lined the sidewalk. Someone taped Deanna's photo to a streetlight pole. Volunteers swept debris from the pavement. Others prayed aloud. The smell of gasoline mixed with candle wax. News crews arrived mid-morning. Reporters framed their shots beside the crumpled cars still in place. The police spokesperson gave a brief statement. A woman was dead after a vehicle struck protesters. One suspect was in custody. The motive remained under investigation. He emphasized that the driver was not an officer and that early signs pointed to impairment rather than intent. For the community, that distinction mattered little. They had spent months protesting what they saw as patterns of disregard. And now, even at a peaceful vigil, someone was gone. By afternoon, Deanna's family released a statement through friends. They described her as a mother, a caretaker, and someone who believed love could rebuild a city. They asked for privacy and peace. Her sister arrived at the site later that day, speaking quietly to those gathered. She thanked them for holding space and reminded them to honor her the way she lived, helping others. At City Hall, officials faced immediate questions. Was the barricade properly permitted? Could police have offered more protection? The mayor called the death a tragedy and promised a full investigation. Activist groups demanded transparency and accountability, even if the act appeared unrelated to law enforcement. To them, it still reflected a climate where protest itself felt unsafe. Detectives from the traffic division began reconstructing the event. They mapped the route of the SUV using surveillance from nearby businesses. They also requested search warrants for phone data and potential blood alcohol results. Meanwhile, prosecutors reviewed early evidence for possible charges. In the following days, the site became a round-the-clock vigil. Flowers, posters, and handwritten notes covered the guardrail. People brought food and water for those standing watch. At night, candles spelled her name on the pavement. Drivers passing slowed down, some honking, others shouting words of support. The emotional tone shifted as grief met anger. Online, some speculated the crash was intentional. Others warned against drawing conclusions before facts were released. The police department urged patience, promising updates once toxicology and witness statements were complete. Inside the community, patience felt hard to keep. A week later, friends organized a march in her memory. They started at the same intersection and walked toward downtown, carrying signs that read "Justice for Deanna." Among them were her co-workers from a local women's shelter, who spoke about her habit of checking in on everyone, the kind of person who left notes reminding others to eat lunch. During the march, speakers recalled that Deanna had posted online about safety at protests just hours before she died. She had written that protecting one another mattered more than shouting the loudest. That message, now haunting, became the closing chant of the night. In the police evidence room, investigators cataloged the vehicle, a battered white SUV with front-end damage and a cracked windshield. Photographs from the scene showed empty beer cans inside. Analysts documented airbag deployment and retrieved the event data recorder to determine speed and braking. The preliminary data suggested the vehicle entered the barricaded area at roughly 70 miles per hour and braked only moments before impact. Combined with witness statements and blood alcohol readings, prosecutors believed they had enough to charge the driver with vehicular homicide and driving under the influence. The press release came 9 days after the crash. The county attorney's office filed 2 counts, criminal vehicular homicide and operation of a motor vehicle under the influence of alcohol. The statement included no speculation about motive. In response, organizers announced a new vigil, not just for mourning, but for accountability. They asked for a permanent memorial at the site and renewed calls for city support to protect protest zones. At the following city council meeting, members debated a proposal to limit unsanctioned street gatherings. Activists argued it was an attempt to silence dissent. The discussion revealed how raw the city still was, balancing grief, protest fatigue, and public safety concerns. Through it all, Deanna's family kept a measured tone. They cooperated with investigators, attended briefings, and requested privacy for her children. Friends described them as exhausted, but determined to see the legal process through. For the public, the story carried layers: the sudden violence, the familiar backdrop of racial justice demonstrations, the question of intent, and the ache of repetition. Minneapolis had seen too many vigils turn to memorials. By midsummer, the flowers on Lake Street had begun to wilt. Rain washed away the chalk messages. Still, people stopped there daily. Some prayed. Some cried. A few simply stood, watching traffic flow again over the same stretch of asphalt. Investigators closed their initial report at the end of July, forwarding the full case file to the prosecutor's office. Toxicology confirmed alcohol levels above the legal limit. The crash reconstruction supported the conclusion that speed and impairment were key factors. Intent could not be proven. For the family, those findings did not ease the loss. For the city, they opened another round of reckoning about safety, protest, and what it means to gather in public grief. The next phase would move to the courtroom. The headlines shifted from vigil death to trial date set. And beneath the surface, one question remained unresolved: how a city still searching for peace could keep finding new reasons to mourn. Chapter 2, The Investigation. In the days after Diana Marie Najdek's death, the intersection of Lake Street and Girard remained a place of stillness. Police tape fluttered in the summer wind. The memorial grew, candles, photos, and signs layered over each other. But behind that quiet scene, detectives from the Minneapolis Police Department's Traffic Division began piecing together what had happened, frame by frame. The driver in custody was identified as Nicholas Kraus, 35, of St. Paul. According to court records, he had prior convictions for driving while intoxicated. On the night of June 20th, he had been released from probation only months earlier. Detectives learned that before the crash, Kraus had been drinking at a nearby bar. Witnesses reported he left abruptly, appearing agitated. Surveillance footage captured his white SUV heading toward uptown around 11:30 p.m. At headquarters, investigators divided tasks. One team handled witness interviews. Another worked with the crash reconstruction unit. A third reviewed the digital evidence, the live streams, phone videos, and social media posts already circulating online. The goal was to verify every moment, where Kraus entered Lake Street, how fast he was traveling, and whether he made any attempt to brake or swerve. The first major lead came from the vehicle's onboard data module. The recorder showed a sudden acceleration 5 seconds before impact. The SUV reached 73 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone. Braking occurred less than a second before collision. Combined with the eyewitness accounts, investigators concluded that the crash was not a simple loss of control. Whether it was deliberate remained open, but the evidence pointed to gross negligence at minimum. In his first interview, Kraus appeared disoriented. Officers described slurred speech and bloodshot eyes. He asked several times, "Is anyone dead?" When told a woman had died, he became quiet. He refused to answer further questions without an attorney. The county attorney's office assigned a senior prosecutor specializing in vehicular homicide. Early that week, she reviewed the police reports and requested lab confirmation of Kraus's blood alcohol level. The toxicology results came back at 0.26, more than 3 times the legal limit. That reading would become a cornerstone of the case. Meanwhile, the public narrative widened. Some voices online insisted the act had to be intentional because the driver accelerated toward a barricade used in racial justice protests. Others pointed out his history of substance abuse and reckless driving. Activists called for transparency and warned against any framing that minimized what had happened. Officials tried to strike balance. They condemned the crash as a preventable tragedy while avoiding speculation about motive. Detective Laura Steen, a veteran of traffic investigations, led the reconstruction effort. She and her team returned to the site several times to map debris patterns and light conditions. They measured the slope of the road, the distance between the last parked car and point of impact, and the visibility from the driver's line of sight. Everything was logged: weather, surface temperature, streetlight brightness. Each new piece of evidence added precision, but not closure. The footage remained the most haunting element. Reviewers in the lab watched frame by frame as headlights cut through the crowd, as people scattered, as one figure remained still. They paused, rewound, and paused again. For investigators, even seasoned ones, that repetition carried a weight beyond paperwork. At the same time, the legal framing advanced. On June 23, prosecutors charged Kraus with 2 counts of criminal vehicular homicide, one for operating a vehicle in a grossly negligent manner, and one for doing so while under the influence of alcohol. He made his first court appearance via video link, wearing a jail-issued jumpsuit. The judge set bail at $1 million. Reporters filled the courtroom feed. The prosecutor outlined the state's preliminary evidence, video, witness testimony, and toxicology. Kraus's defense attorney entered no plea, stating his client was still processing the gravity of the event. The judge ordered a mental health evaluation and continued the case to July. Outside the courthouse, activists and family members of Diana gathered with signs. Her sister read a statement to cameras. She was standing for justice. "We ask that her death not be lost in paperwork. This was not an accident. This was recklessness that killed a human being." In the following weeks, investigators continued building the timeline. They obtained GPS data showing Kraus's route from the bar to Lake Street. They interviewed bar staff, who recalled him ordering multiple drinks and refusing a ride home. A friend told police that Kraus had mentioned wanting to drive through barricades earlier that night but claimed he was joking. That line, included in a sworn statement, raised new questions for prosecutors about intent. Still, proving intent in court required more than offhand remarks. The defense argued that the statement reflected intoxicated banter, not motive. They emphasized that Kraus had no known connection to the protest movement and no documented political affiliations. By mid-July, the case file exceeded 200 pages. Alongside technical data were the human details, photos of the scene, diagrams, phone screenshots, and transcribed interviews. Detectives double-checked timestamps against digital metadata to prevent misinformation. Meanwhile, Deanna's family prepared for her funeral. It was held in a packed church on the north side of Minneapolis. Speakers included community leaders and clergy who had walked with her during previous marches. The service was streamed online for those who couldn't attend. White roses covered the casket. Her daughters sat in the front row, holding hands. The next morning, the county attorney met with reporters. She described the case as clear in evidence but heavy in consequence. She reaffirmed that the prosecution's position focused on intoxication and gross negligence, not political motive. That statement drew criticism from some activists who felt the emotional context, a protest zone, a car breaching a barricade, could not be separated from intent. Across the city, public opinion divided along familiar lines. Some saw a drunk driver's reckless act. Others saw another chapter in the city's cycle of violence tied to protest and policing. Detectives pressed on with what they could prove. They reconstructed the crash in a digital model using 3D software. The simulation confirmed that, given speed and distance, the driver had more than 5 seconds to see the barricade and at least 2 seconds to attempt braking. To prosecutors, that reinforced the case for gross negligence, which under Minnesota law carries the same weight as reckless disregard for human life. As trial preparations advanced, community organizers planned a day of remembrance. They chose the site at Lake and Girard, where fresh paint on the pavement spelled Deanna's name again in white block letters. Volunteers installed a permanent signpost marking the date and her age. During the memorial, speakers read from her social media posts. One line stood out: "We have to keep showing up even when it hurts." It became a refrain for the evening. Behind the scenes, the defense sought a plea negotiation. They proposed that Kraus plead guilty to one count of vehicular homicide in exchange for a reduced sentence recommendation. The prosecution refused, citing the aggravating factors: high speed, extreme intoxication, and the context of a protest area with visible pedestrians. In late August, the judge set a tentative trial date for early 2022. Court documents showed that both sides anticipated calling more than 20 witnesses, including crash reconstruction experts and eyewitnesses from the crowd. Public attention began to drift as other headlines filled the news cycle. But for those directly affected, the case remained a constant presence. Every procedural delay reopened grief. For Detective Steen, the file on her desk represented not only a completed investigation, but a question she could not answer: how to balance fact and feeling in a city already overwhelmed by both. Her final report summarized it simply. The vehicle, traveling at a high rate of speed, entered a controlled protest area, resulting in one fatality. Impairment was confirmed. Intent undetermined. By autumn, the legal process slowed to the rhythm of court schedules. Motions were filed. Expert reports were exchanged. Outside, the memorial weathered rain and wind but remained intact. Someone repainted the lettering after each storm. For Minneapolis, this case joined a long list of open wounds, not from confrontation between police and civilians, but from a single moment where grief met recklessness on the same street. And as the first snow arrived, the courthouse calendar confirmed what everyone already expected: another winter of waiting. The next chapter would determine not only guilt or innocence, but what justice could mean for a family, a community, and a city still learning how to breathe after loss. Chapter 3, The Reckoning. Winter came early to Minneapolis in 2021. Snow settled along Lake Street, softening the outlines of buildings still marked by murals and broken windows. At the intersection of Lake and Girard, candles flickered beneath a thin layer of frost. The sign bearing Deanna Marie Najdek's name leaned slightly from the wind, but people still stopped there, a moment's pause before continuing with their day. Inside the Hennepin County Courthouse, the case against Nicholas Kraus moved toward trial. Months had passed since the crash, but the file remained heavy. The prosecution refined its narrative: a man drunk and speeding, ignored barricades, and killed a protester. The defense prepared to argue diminished intent, that intoxication clouded reason, and that the act, while reckless, lacked malice. Jury selection began in late January 2022. Reporters filled the hallway, camera crews waiting for updates. Inside the courtroom, 12 jurors and two alternates took their seats. The judge reminded them that their duty was to weigh evidence, not emotion. The prosecution opened first. Assistant County Attorney Megan Ellis spoke calmly, walking the jury through photos of the scene. She described the speed, the impact, and the confirmed blood alcohol reading. "This case is about a choice," she said. "A choice to drive impaired, a choice to accelerate toward people, a choice that ended a life." The defense countered with a plea for understanding. Krause's attorney admitted his client was drunk, but argued that he had not meant to harm anyone. "He panicked," the attorney said. "He misjudged what he saw in front of him. He thought he was striking empty vehicles." The defense framed the event as tragic but unintentional. Over several days, witnesses took the stand. Protesters who had been there recounted the moment of impact. Their voices trembled as they described the headlights and the screams. A police officer detailed the field sobriety test. A lab technician explained the toxicology process. Each testimony added to the sequence of minutes that changed multiple lives. When the crash reconstruction expert testified, the courtroom went silent. Using a computer model, he replayed the digital reconstruction on a screen. Lines showed speed, braking, and trajectory. The model confirmed that Krause had more than enough distance to stop, but pressed the accelerator instead. The expert concluded that impairment severely affected his judgment. Midway through the trial, the defense presented their case. They called a psychologist who testified about alcohol-induced blackout states and impulsive behavior. They also showed photos of Krause's vehicle after the crash, emphasizing the damage as evidence of panic rather than planning. Krause chose not to testify. He sat quietly beside his attorney, often looking down. When the prosecutor read Deanna's name aloud during closing arguments, he wiped his eyes but said nothing. The jury deliberated for 2 days. On the afternoon of the second day, word spread that a verdict had been reached. The courtroom filled again, family members, reporters, activists, and city officials. The foreperson handed the paper to the judge. The clerk read aloud. "Count 1, criminal vehicular homicide, guilty. Count 2, driving under the influence, guilty." Deanna's sister closed her eyes, holding the hands of two relatives beside her. The judge thanked the jury for their service and set a date for sentencing. Outside the courthouse, the cold wind carried both relief and exhaustion. Reporters asked for comments. The family released a short statement. "We thank those who stood with us. Nothing can bring her back, but we hope this helps prevent another loss." At sentencing, held in March 2022, Krause faced a maximum of 8 years under state guidelines. The prosecution requested the upper range, citing the extreme intoxication and the public setting of the crash. The defense asked for leniency, noting his cooperation after arrest and expressed remorse. When given the chance to speak, Krause stood and faced the family. His voice was low. "I wish it was me instead," he said. "I was drunk and I destroyed lives. I can't change it, but I am sorry." The judge acknowledged his statement, then read the sentence. 8 years in state prison, with credit for time served. The courtroom was quiet except for quiet sobs from the benches. The legal process ended that day, but for the community, the reckoning had only begun. In the weeks following the sentencing, activists renewed calls for stronger protections at protests. They urged the city to provide official barricades and police escorts for large gatherings. City officials promised a review, but stopped short of new policy. The debate reopened familiar divides between safety and protest freedom, between accountability and fatigue. Deanna's family turned their energy toward remembrance rather than confrontation. They launched a scholarship fund in her name for single mothers pursuing social work or community leadership. Each June, they planned to host a volunteer day, collecting supplies for shelters and youth centers. At the intersection where she died, artists repainted the pavement with bright colors and her initials. Every year since, the mural has been refreshed by local volunteers. The story of her death entered documentaries and local broadcasts about protest safety. Some told it as a tragedy of impaired driving, others as part of a larger narrative about civic unrest and recovery. But those who knew her preferred to keep focus on her kindness, the woman who showed up quietly and stayed until cleanup was done. In interviews, her friends recalled her words from the night before she died. "We have to keep each other safe." That phrase became the motto for their volunteer network. As the second anniversary approached, the family returned to the site. They lit candles again, standing in silence. The city had changed in visible ways, new buildings, repaved roads, but that corner remained a symbol of both pain and persistence. The crash report and trial transcripts became part of public record, studied in discussions about protest safety nationwide. In training materials for event marshals, her case appeared as an example of why clear barricade planning and traffic control save lives. For Minneapolis, it was another reminder of how fragile public spaces can be when grief meets chaos. Detective Steen, now assigned to a different division, kept one photograph from the case, a sunrise shot taken the morning after the crash, the street empty and washed clean by rain. She said it helped her remember that beyond paperwork, every file represents people who were loved. The final entry in the prosecutor's summary closed the file with simple language. Outcome: defendant convicted. Sentence served per statute. Victim remembered by family and community. Public advocacy ongoing. For the people who knew Deanna, the reckoning was not only about punishment. It was about choosing to keep showing up, the same way she did, with compassion stronger than anger, and hope still alive on the street where she fell.